Hello guys, I'm Alice. Sorry for being late. I haven't been in London for a while. I forgot what the tube is like. I'll just tell you a bit about myself before we start. I'm a permaculture designer and a freelance writer, and I've been living in the Middle East for about 10 years now, mostly in Palestine. Have any of you guys been to Palestine? Just to engage you. You have. So generally not so much. Interestingly, I sort of came to permaculture through Palestine. It's not that I went there to do it. It's that when I was there, with the situation in Palestine as it is, I thought that permaculture would be like the most appropriate way of tackling, or the most effective way perhaps, and maybe the most empowering way certainly, of tackling some of the problems that you see in Palestine today. Which obviously it's quite an individual situation. It's under military occupation and it's being actively colonised, which creates quite sort of special circumstances for anything that you try to do. The two organisations I work with now are Bispokes.org, which is a consulting company for sustainable agriculture solutions that myself and some friends have set up over the years, kind of after working in the Middle East a bit. We work in Palestine, Jordan and Egypt a little bit, mostly. Sometimes in other places now, but we started in Palestine. And Green Palestine, which is Grassroots Environmental Action Network Palestine, where we try to do quite a lot of permaculture actually, but like trying to kind of take practical action to improve people's situation and protect the environment, which can be much the same thing sometimes. Please feel free to ask any questions like as we go along if something comes up that inspires you or perplexes you. I'm going to give a bit of an outline today about the role of trees in the conflict, because I think there's a lot of interesting lenses for looking at the conflict. I think the environment is a very instructive lens to look through, because when you talk about colonialism, really you're talking about control of resources, like the land-water nexus is such an important way of manifesting control. It's very useful to, I think that a lot of things that the Israelis do make a lot of sense in the context of the environment, if you understand it as a mechanism of control and a sort of tool for colonialism, actually makes loads of sense, most of the things that they do. To go back to trees and the role of trees, which is like one element of that kind of complex. Let's think about the role that they have played like in the region for a long time. It's obviously a really important element of the landscape. Actually, the Middle East, as we know, is like the cradle of civilization, agriculture, and three world religions, so it's quite interesting all by itself. It's also the site where some of the first trees were ever domesticated. So if you look at like archaeological sites down in Jericho, for example, you find like the earliest evidence of people domesticating fig trees. Figs being a particularly easy tree to domesticate because you can just cut a branch and it roots in really easily and stick it in the ground. So figs would be the first about like 9,000 BC. So like even right in the very beginnings of agriculture, you find people cultivating fig trees. Olives also became cultivated like sometime later, because the wild olive actually took a fair amount of work to like become domesticated. Figs are very easy to domesticate because wild figs are edible anyway, so it's just like selecting slightly bigger, slightly sweeter figs. But wild olives are teeny little things, and the trees are hardest to domesticate. It will work for people to like get into that. And like now, today, most olive trees are grafted, which is a bit more complex, you know, than like just rooting in and cuttings, which we do with figs. Almonds, a little bit later. Again, almonds, like wild almonds, are actually poisonous. It's a single mutation for them to go from being poisonous to being like edible. It's like one site on one gene. It's quite early on the trees to be domesticating, but it's more complicated than either olive or figs, because wild olives also will not poison you. It took them a while to like fix that mutation on the almonds. So what you see is like over time people doing more and more to kind of grow trees and actually like modifying the landscape itself like through their kind of cultivation. So like a feature of the whole area is like ancient olive terraces, and you can see like whole mountainsides changed, and lots of orchards, lots of like soil stabilization. it's quite interesting when you look at those orchards as well, because they're quite sort of interwoven with the native flora now. Like, you find lots of native trees kind of going through it. Like, a lot of the terraces are kind of held up by wild oak trees now, because they would otherwise sort of fall down. Find lots of wild pistachios growing through there. A few trees of interest I thought I'd show you just for fun. So this is the tree of the Bedawi. It's in Al-Walajya, which is a village just outside of Bethlehem. This tree has been estimated by two teams of scientists to be between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. It's possibly the oldest olive tree in the world. Very beautiful tree. It's unfortunately, like now, very close to where they're building the wall around Al-Walajya. So it's kind of threatened, possibly. There's a lot of olive trees have been torn out to build the apartheid wall that Israel's putting up between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But it is amazing to see this tree and like stand there and look at it and realise how much history has gone on around it while it was still living. Outdates the Romans even in the area. So other bits of like evidence, also just interesting to know, of kind of the role that trees have played throughout history in defining cultures and even kind of politics and wars. So Lebanese cedar was like a huge and important product for quite some time. The cedar forests were actually decimated because people used cedar so much to build palaces, but also to build warships. So this was like a big part of it. So it was a really prized product, but also who controlled the cedar trade had the most ships, and then also controlled trade in general on the Mediterranean now. Also like attack their enemies. And also incense grown in the Jordan Valley, which is a really valuable product. Like, armies used to guard their incense trees. This is another like thing that is a piece of evidence that shows you the role of trees in the area. It's the Madaba mosaic, which is from the 6th century, so a bit later. It's on the nave of a church in Jordan in Madaba. And what's on the map is like pictures of the products that were important to trade at the time. So you can see pictures of like lots of date palms around Jericho, and also of like opo balsam, which is the incense I was talking about. Took me a while to figure out what it was. But this tree has like an interesting history, because it was cultivated in the Jordan Valley, and when the Romans stormed the area, the Jews actually tried to burn down all the incense groves because they didn't want them to have them. But the Romans kind of took them off them. And then they actually sort of transplanted the tree and took it to Cairo and some other places, because before that it only grew in the Jordan Valley, generally. So it was like a really, really valuable kind of trade commodity. But this is a picture of a janissary of the Ottomans, actually, that sort of passed to the Ottomans, guarding an opo balsam tree in Cairo. And they, basically it was so highly prized that people had like private armies just to guard their incense groves. Back in the day. This is a date tree that was germinated from 2,000-year-old seeds that they found in Masada, which was stored in a jar, and yeah, they managed to germinate the seeds from the fusilla date, but it goes to show you like how long the seeds can also remain viable from trees. We see that trees have played like a really, really important role in shaping like human cultures and even the outcomes of some human conflicts, or even people have fought conflicts over controlling food crops, and they formed like played a vital role in forming the landscape. It's something also to realise that the soils of the Middle East, like if you go up onto the ridgeways in Palestine, it's like there's a lot of soil up there of quite good quality. And that soil was formed like under oak and pistachio forests. So people say like centuries ago that a squirrel could run from Damascus to Jerusalem without touching the ground. Important to realise that like, Middle Eastern forests are not as we kind of think of forests, and it's actually been a problem in the sort of colonial mentality when people have gone to Palestine and tried to kind of reforest it. But you have what's called like sclerophyllous, I said that right, probably, vegetation. It's a sort of Mediterranean steppe vegetation. So the trees are quite small. It's more a sort of forest where you walk sort of in between the trees than underneath them. But you have like a lot of tree cover. So you can have lots of Mediterranean oak trees, one called like Quercus calaprinus, like, which is, it doesn't look like we understand oak trees to look. It's an evergreen tree with like, it basically looks more like holly than like an oak. So it's a scrubby little thing, really, really tough. And yeah, wild pistachio trees and things like that. But that's what the tree cover was like. That tree cover has been like progressively stripped back and back in order to make way for agriculture. Like that's a really ancient phenomenon. People like clearing out, and I think people probably started clearing the ridgeways first actually, because they're much easier to farm than any other kind of scenario. So people have been stripping out those trees to make way for agriculture for a while. Also, when we talk of the Lebanese cedars, throwing another bit of evidence, the Epic of Gilgamesh is actually probably one of the earliest records of like complete environmental catastrophe caused by deforestation that there is. It's like worth a read, it's quite interesting. It dates back to that. Jordan's oak and pistachio forests were cleared to make way for the Hejaz Railway somewhat later. So we actually have like meteorological records as well from that era. And we know that when they cut down the oak and pistachio forests in Jordan, the rainfall declined. Like, there's actually quite a clear correlation between that. So we know that like deforestation has been a process that's been going on like in the Middle East for 10 centuries, and that is how it's kind of transformed itself from like being known as the Fertile Crescent to being like better known for its deserts and desertification. So we know that there's like a big process of degeneration that's gone forward, and that's really, really connected with losing the trees. Like, trees transform landscapes. The wild vegetation is the start of the landscape in a way. It's what has built the soils. So you start to clear it out, you can have a different kind of landscape, but like the more you clear back these things, the more you start to lose soil, and even the weather starts to change, as it has done in Jordan. Quite something to think about. Okay, so yeah, looking at like trees and the Palestinians, huge part of Palestinian culture, of course, is like all connected up with the cultivation of trees. Like the olive tree in particular is like so sort of emblematic of Palestinian culture. Olive oil is such a like pivotal component of the diet as well. Like, everyone eats olive oil every single day, pretty much. So people take huge pride in their trees, and of course, as you see, the trees can live for like thousands of years, so they're huge heirlooms in Palestinian families as well. Like, inheriting your grandfather's trees is such a big deal, and people have names for their trees as well. Like, the biggest and the oldest ones all have their own names. We know like the ancient sort of terraces, which is not as good quality as I thought. You have a lot of hillsides like this that are sort of transformed into olive terraces that have stood for thousands of years. You have like essentially what you might call a cultural landscape. It's when people's like culture kind of weaves itself into the structure of the landscape around them, and that's what sort of Palestine represents. Both between the mountains and the sort of farmer culture, the Fellahin culture of the mountains, and the Bedouin cultures of the sort of deserts, the pastoralist cultures, you can see it. Like, you know what you're looking for. You can see that those cultures have transformed the landscapes around them, that the landscape is a reflection of them, and they are a reflection of the landscape. It's a sort of co-evolution process between like people and their culture, and what is possible like within the environment that they're in. And the things that they do that also change the environment is like a two-way process. Which also shapes, of course, food and culture. So we'll determine what you can grow. Of course, like wild olive is part of the landscape, it was domesticated from the same landscape. So the fact that everyone eats olive oil is not really a mistake. Wheat is a Middle Eastern crop that was domesticated from the wild crops around it. All of that is like a big part. It's no mistake that the Bedouins eat mansaf all the time. Like, what else are you going to eat? But loads of lamb and yogurt and milk. All of this stuff kind of interweaves to create like quite a sort of complex picture. Palestinian land tenure laws also kind of reflect people's attitude towards trees. So there's an issue that if you rent land, like until today, if you rent land like as a farmer, you're not allowed to plant olive trees. You're allowed to manage the olive trees that are there. And you're allowed to plant apricots and almonds because they only live for 40 years. But the point is that if you plant olive trees, like if you own trees on a piece of land, it sort of gives you the right to that land. And olives live for so long that landlords don't want people to plant them because then it like sort of muddies the waters of who has the right to the land. And that's something that's like kind of quite even entrenched in Palestinian culture. It's not always enforced now, but it certainly like was part of the kind of legal understanding of it. people like also had different systems like for managing land within a village, between like communal land that they used to use for cereal cultivation and olive trees, which of course like ran down through families. The Ottomans created a law when they came to Palestine, which was in the sort of 15th century, to essentially it was a colonial law, it was a law of empire, that if you were cultivating land, basically what they said was that all the land that anyone held at all was held in usufruct, which means it belonged to the state, but people are allowed to farm it. So the Ottomans kind of changed the conception of land ownership. So basically all of it belongs to the state. And if you're farming it, we're letting you farm it. If you don't farm it, so they're basically saying to the farmers, because they wanted to tax them, like, if you are not being productive on your land, so that if you're not paying taxes to the empire, we'll kick you off it, because it belongs to us in the first place, and give it to someone else. Now, this is a sort of land concept. It goes back a long way. Actually, like, it is the legal construct that the Cubans put in, like, after the revolution, because they, and during the special period, because they needed to redistribute, like, state lands there. They had a very centralised farming system, so they like gave out land, parcels of land, to anyone who was willing to farm it, but you have to be productive on it or you get kicked off. Because like Palestine land tenure goes back a long way, and there's a mechanism for the empire to sort of force farmers to be productive and to pay taxes and accumulate wealth for their centre. And this issue of like absentee land law is actually something that Israel never repealed, and they still use it until this day in order to kick Palestinians off their land, like, to put it inelegantly. This is like the sort of fundamental thing in the bottom of it. It's called absentee land law. Like, if you don't farm land, then it can be confiscated by the state. It belongs to the state, and they can give it to someone else. Okay, so let's talk a bit about trees and Zionism. Well, Zionism is the same concept, quite a new concept. Of course, the like 20th century really became a thing. There's a huge part of the narrative of Zionism that Palestine was a barren land when they came, that it was like empty and destroyed, and yeah, basically it wasn't all being looked after, it was crying out for its people to come back and put it all to rights. This is a quote from the JNF's website. When the pioneers of the state arrived, they were greeted by barren land to claim the land that had been purchased with the coins collected in JNF blue and white pushkas. The next order of business was to plant trees among the rocky hillsides. And so effectively, like, what the Zionists had done was like collect loads of money globally in order to buy land, like sometimes buy it. You know that like a lot of it was not bought, but this is how they started. This is what the JNF was. It was like the land acquisition arm of the Zionist movement. It was founded like right at the beginning of the 20th century in order to like acquire land for the Zionist enterprise. And they, you know, and until now, this like narrative is like a huge part of it. So the JNF still manages to collect money like globally off kind of charitable institutions to plant trees in the land of Israel. And this is something that people around the world are still convinced that what they're doing is redeeming the land. Like, that's what they think they're doing. That, you know, planting trees is clearly a good thing. Oh, yes, let's go back. This is a picture of Canada Park, which actually sort of illustrates the point quite well of like what tree planting actually really amounts to, because we know that like fundamentally it's a tool for controlling the land in the hands of the Zionists and for getting it off people, transforming it into something else, like removing one culture and imposing another culture kind of on top of it. And nature parks is like one of the tools. There's like several, but nature parks is one. So Canada Park is on the land of Latrune. It's planted up by the JNF. In the 1970s, like this is land that was seized in the 1967 war, actually. It's kind of really quite close to Jerusalem, a little to the west. If you look at like a map of the West Bank and Jerusalem, you can see that Jerusalem, like in a logical sense, should not be part of Israel. It doesn't really make any sense that it is part of Israel. Like, it was kind of seized in 48, you know, they had like such a strong attachment to the idea of like having Jerusalem. Like West Jerusalem was kind of seized and the border like ran through the middle of the city, like Jordan held the West Bank and like East Jerusalem. Anyway, there's two like big bits of land that jut out to the west of Jerusalem that are part of like Palestinian territory. and the latrines a little bit away to the southwest. And in 1967, it's called the latrine or something, the Israelis seized a load of land like around Latrun, which is a Christian monastery, like depopulated four Palestinian villages that you see there. So it was Imwas, Yalu, Deir Ayub, and Latrun, kicked out about like 7,000, 8,000 people, and then planted loads of trees like over the top of the land. It's not the first time this has happened. There's other places around Jerusalem. So what you could see, like if you go in there, it's like a lot of archaeological remains that they're very proud of, which are like sort of Roman bathhouses and stuff. The remains of like decimated Palestinian villages, they're not labelled, so like there's all these sort of pointers to like ancient history, especially if there's like any evidence for Jewish presence in the land, that's like really highlighted, but all the evidence of the Palestinians and their villages is kind of wiped out, it's not highlighted. Instead you have like a nature park on top of it. What you can see, like, if you go in there, there's, like, what you can tell were, like, farmers' terraces. So, like, there's lots of old terrace walls. But instead of the sort of cultivated trees that the farmers would have had, you find pine trees. And if you go into these forests, like, there's another one close to Ein Karim, which is also near Jerusalem. You don't really hear a bird singing in them because they've planted a species of alien pine tree that is non-native to the area, so the birds don't like it. So they create a kind of, it looks like a forest, but it's in many ways it's a desert for the fauna because they're not used to those trees. And in any case, like also the pine trees change the soil so that you can't farm under them anymore because pine's quite an aggressive tree that like has allelopathic compounds in its needles, so when pine needles fall onto the forest floor, they stop other things from germinating under them. And they start to change the chemistry of the soil, so it's much harder to cultivate the soil like after pine trees anyway. So it's a real like situation of transforming reality, like transforming a landscape and transforming like your conception of ownership. So you go there, throw everyone out, like move them, destroy all their houses, destroy their villages, destroy their trees as well, because, like, I mean, there's a lot of stories from, like, 48, 67 of farmers, like, sneaking back in order to, like, refugees sneaking back in order to harvest their crops. But if you kill their trees and, like, take them away and put different trees in their place, which also make it impossible to actually, like, re-farm the area anyway, even if they did get it back, you change reality, right? You change the landscape, you like manage to manifest like a different vision, and you change the law on that like piece of land, because the law of them is that it's a park, so it's forbidden to farm because it's a park and it's protected. And this is a strategy that you actually, I mean, it's not over, like this is a strategy you see Israel using again and again. So yeah, to sort of recapping those points. This is a sign from God's TV forest, which is in the Negev, which is a bizarre phenomenon, I tell you. The money for this, like to go back to the earlier point of like how these things are kind of manifested, the money for this is collected off Christian Zionists in the US, actually, via like this ludicrous TV channel that they're running, where they're like, oh, give us money to plant trees in the Holy Land, it's very important. They managed to get like money to plant thousands of trees like across the Negev on a piece of land that Bedouin are being evicted from like now. I'll show you some pictures from the village of Arakiva in a minute. You can see like the narrative that they're playing there. It's like you're redeeming the land, you're doing a good thing, you're planting like trees in the land of Israel in the Holy Land. It's also a mechanism of erasing history, so you can like erase all the traces, the cultural landscape of the people who were before you, you just get rid of it and put a new kind of reality there. You create facts on the ground, both physically, as we say, by like changing the soil and the trees and the like buildings there to get that. You create environmental facts. Once you've planted trees as well, it's quite easy to seize the moral high ground if anyone damages your trees, because everyone recognises that like damaging trees is very bad. Cutting trees down is very bad. And grazing animals in a like state-protected forest is very bad. So you manage to kind of like put yourself on this moral high ground. Yeah, you can bring in a whole like suite of legal like measures as well around that to kind of protect your rights on the land and say, well, this is legal, this is not legal, this is a legitimate use of the land, which you like see a lot in the Israeli narrative. Like, what is a legitimate use of the land? Basically anything that they want to do. So, but like legitimate uses of the land include state-protected parks or agriculture, like intensive agriculture. That's another like legitimate use of the land. And you can see this like a lot in the case of the Bedouin, like our form of agriculture is more legitimate than your form of agriculture kind of narrative, which people just swallow really easily as well. Like, everyone's really happy to say that like the Bedouin are really destructive and overgrazing is destroying the environment, but industrial agriculture is fine. So, you know, this is like, it's an entitlement complex, effectively, that you kind of build up, but you just make it seem really reasonable, so everyone who looks at it is like, yeah, it's very good. You know, like, Israel have done a really good job at creating an image where they are the protectors of the environment, and the Palestinians and the Bedouins destroy the environment. They're always just throwing rubbish everywhere. You know, at the same time that Israel is actually kind of uprooting millions of trees and preventing people from like managing their relationship with the environment at all. So these are some pictures from the village of Al-Araqib, which is a Bedouin village. Another point about this is like a Palestinian community inside Israel. So these are Israeli citizens, actually, who pay taxes for the state. Al-Araqib was demolished last month for the 84th time in the last, like, 5-6 years. They're called, like, squatters on state land, despite the fact that Al-Araqib as a village has existed since before the state of Israel, which is still considered to be illegal squatters, because the state doesn't recognise that the Bedouin have any right to, like, live on the land. They don't have no land rights because it wasn't registered somehow, like, their land claim has not been registered. Doesn't recognise them as the indigenous people of the Negev, like, effectively just says, yeah, anyway, the state, like, in the 60s built, like, a number of cities that they wanted the Bedouin to live in, and what they said was, well, you can live legally there, and anything else you do is illegal. It was a cultural genocide, like, very fundamentally, because what they did in the cities was made no possibility for the Bedouin to live as Bedouin. It's like, well, you will live in this box, and you will work in that factory, and that's it. Like, there are no other options. There's not enough land in them to farm. They made, like, grazing illegal and planting crops illegal and just declared all the land, like, that wasn't in those cities as state land. So anyone who was present on it doing anything at all was a squatter, an illegal squatter. So this, like, struggle is going on until today. There's this thing called the Prava Plan, which plans to forcibly relocate 70,000 Bedouins who refuse to live in those cities, make them live in those cities. And Al-Araqib is one such village where they struggled really courageously, and the state is trying to make an example of them, so they keep, like, demolishing them. I mean, most of the people have left. Like, there were maybe 1,000 people in Al-Araqib, like, 10 years ago. Not anymore. There's, like, a few kind of diehard, like, people who always rebuild their tents, maybe, like, 5 families who have just completely refused to leave. And so, yeah, what you can see is, like, it was a really, like, functional community, like, even 8 years ago, I think. They had, like, thousands of olive trees, they'd, like, built themselves a functional dwelling, some people were starting to build houses, like, they had a, like, system for, like, water and electricity and all this kind of thing. And now it's really, like, I mean, it's a shack, and they've all been driven back to, like, living in the cemetery because it's the only place of land that they kind of feel that they can build on. And so, yeah, you can see, like, the state tore down, like, 1,000 olive trees. You can, like, see a dead olive tree there, and, like, stormed them, like, so many times with, like, tear gas, and really, really brutal, demolished their homes. And here you can see a soldier, like, planting an olive tree, like, on land that was, like, cleared. Not an olive tree, just a tree. So, yeah, from God's TV, this is how God's TV forest is planted, actually. Like this is the whole kind of cycle. Like, you clean them off, this is how land is redeemed in Israel, right? You, like, go in there, like, brutalize everyone who lives there, smash up all their stuff, and then you plant trees on it. Job done. So, yeah, this is something that it's not just Israel where this happens. So it's something that's being manifested against the Bedouin. It's being manifested against the Palestinians also for years, like, partially to make way for the wall, but also because of settlements, military roads, military bases, like, anything in the West Bank. So we know there's, like, 500,000 settlers now living in the West Bank illegal colonists. And the strategy of the Negev, I mean, that's actually been going on a bit longer, because it's been going on like ever since the state began. Like, the Negev has been being cleared of Bedouin like since the 40s, but since like 1967, like, this has just extended like onto the West Bank. So yeah, and in order to make way for the wall, like 500,000 olive trees have been like torn down. Some really, really old. Like, people are still worried for the tree of the Bedouin because so many other olive trees have been smashed. This is a picture actually that my permaculture students took in Kastagasia. I used to like teach permaculture in the Negev. This is the state bulldozers taking out the barley crops of the community because they're illegal barley. So they brought loads of bulldozers and just ploughed it up, and you can sort of see all the topsoil just blowing away in the wind. But illegal planting on what? Like, you know, this is very bad. Clearly a threat to the security of the state to have barley growing on those hills. This is how it manifests, and there's like thousands and thousands of dunams as well of like Bedouin crops that are just like blazed every year. So let's say that on the Palestinian side, like, trees have come to like symbolise resistance quite a lot as well. And loads of communities have kind of, lots of organisations and people have like moved to start planting trees, because like from the other side, like in resisting colonisation, like the trees are such an important like fundamental part of Palestinian culture, and planting trees is like such a symbolic act of hope. Because, I mean, even if you plant an olive tree, like, it's not going to give you any olives for 3 years. So it's kind of a statement about permanence as well. And olive trees, as we know, can like live for thousands of years. So if you can be bothered to plant them, say, no, we're staying here. Like, we will be here, and these trees will be here. Some of it like is to replace destroyed trees. So like a lot of it has been in aid to farmers who lost like land and trees, to like give them back something, because they were like really economically hard hit. And Palestinian farming has been smashed in the last like decades since the beginning of the Israeli state. I have to say, like, it's not just about trees, it's also about like water, very fundamentally, and that would be another whole talk that you could do about like how water is kind of controlled and distributed. That's like another mechanism. So this tree planting campaign is also of like economic significance, manifest presence on the land. Of course, it also like manifests repair of the environment and care for the environment. You see like trees torn down, as we said, like in Jordan when they destroyed the pistachio forest, the rain went away. The Middle East is facing some pretty horrific consequences of climate change as well. Like, it's expected to be more significant to them there. Like, the fall in precipitation will be bigger, the like temperature raise will be bigger. Like, it's expected to kind of suffer that. But deforestation assuredly is also playing a part in that complex. So you cut the trees down, it stops raining. Simply explain that, like, when rain falls down, one, like, trees open up channels like in the soil for water to soak in, so that it goes into like underground aquifers and you can access it later. But trees also transpire water with the like from the ground, so they soak it up through their roots and like release it into the sky from their leaves. And if it wasn't for trees, like, every continental interior would be a desert. Like, trees move clouds inland from the sea, if that makes sense. Otherwise the rain would just fall on the first mountain it hit and run back into the sea. Israel, Palestine, you've got like a really significant kind of geographic feature of like the mountain ridge. And like very noticeably, like, the west side of it is wet and the east side of it is not wet. Like, going down the eastern slopes into the Jordan Valley, you run into a desert because it's a rain shadow. So the rain sort of falls on the west face of it. The more trees you remove, the less like chance there is of any rain moving inland, which is very significant for people in Jordan. because they rely on that, actually, like, the clouds would move across. Planting trees has environmental significance. Well, of course, also, if you, like, take away trees, you start losing soil, and if you lose all your soil, then you have no environmental capital whatsoever to work with, and you can't grow anything. Amazing. We need trees to kind of hold that together. Another case, if you actually, with olive terraces, great while they last, if they fall down, all the soil just goes down the mountain. Like, if you have a sort of mountain that's covered in natural vegetation, it's much more stable. Olive terraces are stable as long as you maintain them, but at the moment that they fall, they create huge gullies, and like all the soil will just like crash into the valley really quickly. You won't be able to grow anything on the mountain anymore. Yeah, of course, the trees are a cultural significance. Like, one major like strategy of the Israelis is to destroy the links of the Palestinians with the environment. So it's a process of ghettoization, of like removing people from the land, destroying their self-reliance, so like destroying their agriculture in many ways, and their sense of like belonging. If you have a dependent and ghettoized people like living in cities, which is the process that is going forward in Palestine, like, then it's much easier to control them, and also much easier to like kind of destroy their memory of their connection to the land. Like, a big part of the Palestinian connection to the land is via like their agriculture and their trees. So yeah, this sort of replanting exercise kind of builds the strength of that connection as well, and what we call samud and steadfastness, persistence. So tree planting campaigns are really popular. You have like the Olive Tree Campaign of the Joint Advocacy Initiative, you've got Zaytuna, you've got lots and lots of groups like supporting that, and the Palestinian government as well. I have to say, I've been to quite a lot of tree planting events in the last 10 years, and a lot of the time, like, people love the symbolism of it. Rah, yeah, planting trees, rah. But it doesn't always move much beyond that, because a lot of the trees end up dying, because they don't have access to the water to water them, or like land access can be tricky. Like, they're often planted on pieces of land that are threatened to be confiscated, and there's like quite a lot of military presence and stuff like that. Like, it's most successful when you plant the trees with a farmer who like has a will to maintain them in the first place. But sometimes you like can see thousands of trees planted, and you go back the next year and like two of them will still be alive. I still think, I mean, even as a resistance activity, it's very important. But in order to like get all the other benefits, you do actually need to move beyond symbolism. And permaculture is one route to do that. So you have a lot of challenges working in the Palestinian environment. Water access is a huge one. Fact is that Israel controls like water extraction and distribution like most of the time. And they control where the networks go. So the networks go to settlements. Like, if Israelis want to found like industrial farms, it's really easy for them because they'll just be hooked up immediately. There's like a whole kind of legal construct behind them to like make it easy for them to kind of manifest presence on the land. And there's a whole legal construct making it very difficult for Palestinians to do the same. But the traditional agriculture of the region is actually rain-fed agriculture. Like, people didn't used to have access to like pumping equipment to like bring groundwater up. So you can kind of hark back to that a bit, and how you plant trees is really important, and when you plant them, and which trees you plant. So there's a lot of like scope within permaculture. I don't know how much any of you know about permaculture. Is it a new word? Do people understand what it is? Generally. Yeah, so permaculture is a strategy. It's not like permanent culture. So the sort of zany idea that you should try and live without destroying the environment. Which sounds simple, it's a bit more complicated when you get down to it. But a lot of it is about agriculture. And it draws a lot from like traditional agricultural techniques. So it's like trying to have a low input form of agriculture that also like copies the patterns of nature and like takes them as a template for what you do. And if you look at the history of agriculture, you can see that like the beginnings of agriculture are much more about that. Like, people took all their inspiration from nature, right? Because we didn't have industrial agriculture then. It was all about like looking at what was happening, like noticing patterns and then like using them. That's how like people domesticated trees, by like noticing where they grew, what was going on, like how, which were the best ones, you know, and like taking the seeds from them. Like, well before people understood genetics as tool, they were still like doing quite advanced plant breeding. But people also like understood that time, like how to farm in the environment, like how to use the rain that fell, how to like build the soil, these kinds of things. So in order to actually be successful like, with kind of like landscape level restoration initiatives, let's say like landscape level reforestation or something like that, we need to like reconnect with that, especially when you do not have access to infrastructure. You don't have access to water. You can't just like pump a load of water in. Like with JNF in the Negev, have some quite clever systems as well. Like this is the Jewish National Fund for like planting trees, but they also have all the water that they want. In fact, they've like diverted the Jordan River to the northern Negev effectively, which has had environmental consequences. That's why the Dead Sea is kind of evaporating now. But you know, it's much easier. But on the Palestinian side, you can't do like that kind of infrastructure project. So you need to be a lot smarter than that. You need to like move into kind of rainwater harvesting strategies and these kinds of like things. So permaculture is actually a toolkit for doing that, for like looking at how you can integrate with the environmental conditions and the landscape to actually sort of like manifest farming projects. This is a picture of a really good friend of mine, Abid, putting in like a rainwater harvesting system. So this is a guy who, I'll tell his story because it's a great story. He lived in a cave like in Al Walaja, like on his land, because the Israelis wanted to kick him off. It was his like family's land, his grandfather's land from like a long time ago. And their house was destroyed like in 48, and they became refugees and fled, like many of the people in Al-Walaja, to Dahisha refugee camp in Bethlehem. And he was born there, but he always used to go to the land with his grandfather. And at some point in his life, he realised that he really didn't like living in the refugee camp, and he wanted to farm, and he had land, so he might as well like go there and farm it. But he wasn't allowed to build. Like, he tried to build several times, but his house was demolished by the authorities. So he just moved into a cave that was on the land and put a front door on it, which upset them as well. It was illegal door. But his point was, well, actually, the cave was, like, here before any of us. You know, if you have a problem, take it up with God. But, yeah, he lived there for many years, and he didn't have any infrastructure. Like, I mean, he was living between like two settlements of like Gilo and Har Gilo, and there was actually a water pipeline running across his land, but he was not allowed to touch it. So he had to do like rainwater harvesting and like smart ways of farming. So yeah, some of the like initiatives we did were with Abid, and like one of them was like putting up a zinc roof so that he could harvest rainwater off it in big tanks like this, and water his crops and whatever. And yeah, it's like just to sort of highlight the work that some other organisations are doing now. So people are not like sitting around picking their noses, just like watching the place be colonised completely. Like, people are resisting and doing things. Tree planting is one way, but like moving beyond that as well. In the South Hebron Hills, like the communities they're not connected to the electricity network. This is like another like problem that people have, and it's another mechanism for like kicking people off the land as well. You just don't allow them to connect to any infrastructure. Create a completely false dichotomy where you say to people, like, yeah, look, you can either live on the land and farm like sort of savages, or you can have running water and electricity in a city. It's pretty simple. Like, but you know, it's this idea that like it's really backwards to farm. It's really backwards, and if you want to do it, you have to live in a cave and like with a candle. That's it. And your children won't be able to do their homework at night and stuff like this. But it's really a false dichotomy. There's like no reason why you cannot use like technology, for one thing, to support pastoralist lifestyles, for example. But I mean, the only reason that they don't have electricity as well is because they're Palestinians, because there are settlements like within hundreds of meters of their villages that do have electricity and water. So it's like a complete political construct as much as anything else. So CometMe are an organisation actually founded by Israeli activists who put in renewable electricity systems for people. That's how they started. So they would put in solar panels and wind turbines. And they've moved on now to like doing water systems. So people have rainwater harvesting systems like in those communities generally already, like for their animals, but they would tend to like tank water for themselves. Water quality is a massive issue because, like, tankering water actually, like, really ups the chances of contaminating it, because you get it from the source. Maybe it's all right. Put it in the tanker, probably a bit contaminated. Pump it out into tanks, which are probably a bit dirty, and store it and use it from them. So, like, sort of waterborne diseases are really, really prevalent in those communities. So what Comet have done is, like, follow their electricity systems with water purification systems. So they use the solar power or wind power to like lift the water up out of the cisterns and like put it through mechanical filters into roof tanks and then run it down through slow sand filters so that it reaches drinking water quality. And also like so that people living in these communities can have a sort of what we would take for granted as an ordinary life, you know, like with taps in your house that you like turn on and water comes out of them, this kind of thing. And being able to like have a fridge, stuff like that. But yeah, they're just trying to like make it so that people are not like paying a price for living on the land. You know, they're actually like have access to what we would consider to be like a reasonable standard of life via like electricity systems and water purification systems. And this is like a huge boon. Like this is what allows people like to stay on the land and resist, but not to like pay like a huge kind of sacrifice in doing it. Because like Samud is all very well. It's like good to have steadfastness, but you know, it doesn't have to be like so hard. It doesn't have to be such a high price. Like that's part of the construct that Israel has created in order to make people just give up and like move. So yeah, this is like one way of resisting that. And it's like quite a creative way. And this is another like nice example of a project. So this is along the Jordan Valley Solidarity Campaign. And what they're doing is using earth building in order to resist, because there's a lot of like home demolitions in the area, because Israel doesn't give out building permits for Area C. Basically, like 60% of the West Bank is under complete Israeli control until today. It's got like three land designations. It's Area A, B, and C. It was like invented in Oslo when Israel was supposed to withdraw from the West Bank, but they didn't withdraw. Like the idea was that Area A was the Palestinian cities, and it's under complete like Palestinian security control and civil control. And Israel withdrew from those areas first to allow like elections to go forward. Area B is under Palestinian civil control, but it's got Israeli security control on it. And Area C is under total Israeli control. And like under Oslo, the vision was that more and more land was going to pass from like C to A, and like Israel was going to gradually withdraw from the West Bank. But that obviously hasn't happened. So you're left with like the situation where it's like 62% of the West Bank now is still under Israeli civil and military control, which is actually why this is necessary. Because these areas are under total Israeli civil control. So they're in the Palestinian Authority, like they're in the West Bank, as in the Palestinian territory. But Palestine has absolutely no control over them. So the Palestinian government can't do anything there, even if they wanted to. You can say these communities are quite marginalised, and the PA probably generally don't care that much about the Bedouin. But even if they wanted to do like projects for them, they couldn't do, because they have no jurisdiction whatsoever. So yeah, and in this case, like Israel is demolishing people's houses. They're demolishing them in the Negev. But the JVS are supporting people by rebuilding in mud bricks. It's actually like a sort of multifaceted strategy. Some of what they do is restoring old buildings. So if you can prove that the building was there before 1967... then you can argue in court that they shouldn't demolish it because it was there before 1967. So you just have to like subtly renovate it so that it's more livable and you can live there. If you can't prove that, and like obviously a lot of people can't prove that because a lot of people have built their houses since 1967 without permits, because Israel doesn't give anyone permits. You can apply for them if you like, but you won't get it. Then they come and demolish it. So what JVS do is like they've got this brick machine in, and they make bricks, which is great because it's much cheaper than paying for cement. And also, when it comes to actually rebuilding, for one thing, it's cheaper. For another thing, if your house is demolished, instead of like having a pile of like smashed cement and twisted rebar, you just have a pile of smashed earth bricks, which you can like scrape up and put back together. And also it's more environmentally friendly. So it's another like example of like how permaculture concepts can be used. Now, permaculture, we would say, is not any one of these things. So it's not tree planting, it's not renewable energy, it's not earth building. It's actually a synergy of all of those things and like how you happen to bring them together. So you sort of talk about living sustainably. It's like, well, good, like how are you going to build your house? Like, How are you going to bring your electricity in? How are you going to grow your food? And how are you going to get your water? Think about all of those things. You have like a possibility for using, for one thing, environmental resources that are all around you that we have forgotten how to use, because like in modern times we never had to like think of these things. If you hark back a couple of hundred years, people had to think about these things. Like, no one expected to have like water piped to them. They would have thought about how to harvest it from the landscape in some way, or how to farm, like using the rain that fell and stuff like this. So permaculture is bringing them all together. But what you can see in Palestine is like quite a lot of quite creative projects that are showing at least like one facet. If you can manage to bring all those facets together, then you have a really powerful like toolbox for resisting colonialism and living on the land. So there's some nice like farming projects coming up as well. So I'd say like Palestine, like a lot of the world farming, the ideology of farming for quite some time got quite industrial and technocratic. Like, people thought that was progress. Here as well as there, people really assumed that, like, if you're a modern person, proper farmer, you would like have a lot of chemicals and a lot of machines and this kind of thing, and use a lot of water, have like big irrigation systems to piss it into the sky. But people are like coming back to the idea actually that organic farming has certain advantages. And one like huge issue in Palestine is seed sovereignty. Like, more and more industrial farming is relying on seeds that are actually bought from Israeli companies. And we know they're like hybrid seeds. Like, I mean, in Jordan you can see like Monsanto and Bayer all along the Jordan Valley, like it's the kind of farming companies. But Israel also like are quite sort of leading the charge in like crop breeding. I think like they have a sort of tomato that like costs like thousands of dollars for like a kilo of seeds. Very expensive. And they control all the borders of like Palestine. So if you like allow this kind of infiltration of like farming so that you lose your native seed stock and get these hybrid seeds, which can be like very high yielding, but they tend to be very high input as well. They're really designed for ideal conditions. So if you have like a big flat field and lots of water and access to all the chemical inputs you need, then you can grow them really well. And if you don't, then they probably won't produce that well anyway. Furthermore, like if you come to depend on agrochemicals for farming, then your land like loses its natural fertility over time, so you can't really go back. Well, you can go back, but you have to kind of put up with like a few years of low yield. And you like live in a situation where like Gaza now is under a pretty tight siege. Like, anything that comes in or out of Gaza like does so with Israel's permission or not. And like now the Palestinian like farming market is actually awash with chemicals that are banned internationally, but they're the ones that Israel says that the farmers in Palestine can use. So like lots of really noxious agrochemicals. Yeah, like fundamentally, like a lot of the strength of the food sector in Palestine, like can and should come from like traditional farming and from seed sovereignty and like getting back the old varieties and like figuring out how to farm without like a lot of high inputs, because high inputs create dependency and dependency is probably bad. So yeah, there's like a couple of nice projects. That one you see there is a couple in Tulkarm, Fayez's. Good people. And they run a big organic farm called Hakaretna Farm, where they're kind of reviving organic agriculture at a sort of commercial scale as well. Because a lot of the people you'll see in Palestine say, oh yeah, that's all very well, like, you know, it's all right for my grandfather or whatever, and it's all right for people who don't really like need to make any money, but you can't otherwise like do it because you won't make any money. I mean, it's what people in Gaza say all the time as well, like, you know, these things are all right for everyone else but not for Gaza, because, you know, we've got enough problems here. We don't need to like think about this. But actually, there's a whole complex of problems that come from industrial agriculture that are like feeding back in to like wreck everything. Like Gaza's in a particularly bad case. Like the water in the aquifer, for one thing, doesn't meet international drinking water standards. It's completely like poisoned with seawater, agrochemicals, and sewage. But a lot of the problems are coming from agriculture. That's something you need to like understand when you look at the situations. Like, those problems are being created because you're using loads of agrochemicals that are seeping into the aquifer. And also the aquifer is being overpumped, which is causing seawater to come into it. And 75% of that water is being used by agriculture. So you can sort of see this quite vicious circle going round. Anyway, these like projects that are doing a revival are very important. The second project you see here is Mada Permaculture Farm, which is the first permaculture farm to be founded in Palestine by this guy, Murad Al-Kafash. Very interesting guy, Mr. Wordsworth. So, I just wanted to like outline some of the ways that if people are interested, like you can get involved. Like I said, I work with an organisation called Grassroots Environmental Action Network Palestine. And we have like opportunities continuously for people to like volunteer in Palestine if they want to like go and take up with one of those projects and stay with them, like Jordan Valley Solidarity, who do the earth building, always taking on volunteers, as are like the Marida Farm and Hakaretna, like they can always host people. Very interesting way to see Palestine as well. It's like nice to be able to practically do something while you're there as well. We're also running a project called Rebuild Gaza Sustainably, where actually we've like taken the concept of Jordan Valley Solidarity, of the earth building and like having a machine to make loads of bricks, and we're transferring it to Gaza, because in Gaza they're not able to rebuild at the moment because they can't get any cement because of the siege. So this is like one possible way that people can go around that a bit. It won't solve all the problems because some of Gaza is so urbanised that it's really hard to do earth building there, but there are areas. So we're working with farmers in Gaza because they need to get back on their land and get farming. And we can do projects like that. So we're running events and collecting money and like doing stuff for that. Connected with that, we're running another event called Jordan Valley Perma Blitz in October, which will be open to like volunteers. We're going to get a posse together and go down to the Jordan Valley, and like we'll be connected with the Gaza project because we've actually got a machine being built in Gaza at the moment, so we'll have a live link, but we'll be doing earth building with the people in the Jordan Valley. And some other permaculture activities to like big up their centre. Last of all, like if anyone feels a burning urge to learn permaculture, be running a permaculture design certificate in the Sinai in December. Should be very interesting.